To order, could we begin roll call? Amira Pa here.
David Bateman. Victoria Bell.
Present.
Marcy Benda.
He's absent today.
Nicholas Brennan. Cleveland Bruyere. Jonathan Butcher.
Here.
Anna Fernanda Cardena. Ishan Chowdhury.
Here.
Jason Toberco,
Present.
Bora Durrell, Eve DeRosa, Ellen Gaynor,
Here.
Ellen is here.
Here.
Andy Garcia Ortiz,
present.
Irene Gatimi,
present.
Andrea Helen Mott,
present.
Han Nguyen, Stephanie Resu. Christian Charala,
Present.
Wendy Treat,
Present.
Wendy Theater.
Can you hear us on Zoom?
Are you working on the sound?
You do think
yeah, I think we can't hear the people on Zoom.
Apparently, they're nothing.
So, working on the scene.
Yeah, you're working on the it's like. Intentional, but like you know, on.
No, we cannot hear you on Zoom. As we figure out some of our technical difficulties, I will go ahead and proceed with our land acknowledgement. Cornell University, where this meeting is located, is on the traditional homelands of the Gayokono, the Cayuga Nation. The Gayokono are members of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, an alliance of six sovereign nations with a historic and contemporary presence on this land. The Confederacy precedes the establishment of Cornell University, New York State, and United States of America. We acknowledge the painful history of Gayokono disposition and honor the ongoing connection of Gayokono people past and present to these lands and waters. At this time, I'm going to open the floor to any late additions to the agenda. Seeing that there is none, we are going to close this portion of the meeting and go ahead and move on to the approval of the February 10th meeting minutes. These are on the box for those that are online, for those that are in person, that is in our meeting packet. If you have your laptops open, it's in the box for you as well. I will entertain any motions to amend or approve.
Motion to approve.
Motion to approve.
Second.
Okay, we have a second. Wendy has her hand raised. Hello?
Can you hear me?
You're acknowledged. And we still cannot hear Wendy. So let's try to get this.
Try one more time, Wendy.
Can you hear me now?
Mm-hmm.
Her transcript's not.
Is she saying on the transcript? Okay. Not quite.
Can you try one more time, please, Wendy?
Hello, test, test.
Oh, it's coming out of a different mic. I can like faintly hear it.
Mic or speaker? Maybe we can
a speaker,
turn up.
Yeah.
Are we able to turn up volume?
Yeah, one more try, please, Wendy.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, no, certainly. All right,
one more time, please, Wendy.
One more time, Eric.
Oh, very clean.
You could also just save minutes for after the presentation if we need to.
Absolutely. My only worry is if there's any, especially for the meeting minutes, if there's any amendments that may be.
Yeah, we can withdraw the motion.
Yeah.
You met 10 in front of the
I just I have a
Don't be
friendly amendment.
transphobic.
I'll send it. I have a
You have
friendly
any
amendment. I'll
statements,
send
Eric?
it to the Office of the Assemblies.
Yeah.
So, just to make sure it can proceed, Wendy, is with your hand raised an amendment to the meeting minutes? You cannot, yeah, okay. If you could perhaps type that out.
Yeah, she could put it in chat to you, or we can come back to the minutes after the presentation.
Okay.
We can just put it in.
All right. Is there a motion to move the approval of the minutes later into the agenda?
Sure.
A motion to move?
Second.
Second? Okay, thank you. We can go ahead and move on to the business of the day. Today we have the honor of welcoming President Michael Kaltkof, as well as Vice President for the University Relations, Kyle Kimball, and Provost Katiba Bala.
Kavita, but
Okay.
close enough.
Katiba. Okay. Kavita?
Kavita, thank you.
Kavita. Yes, Bala, thank you. I welcome corrections. Can we go ahead and give them a round of applause for being here with us? Okay, much like last time, we had some topics that we wanted to discuss as well as questions. So, if you wanted to take the floor and talk about anything before we get started.
Sure, just I'll make a few comments and then we can go through the questions. Thanks everybody for being here. I'm delighted to visit the UA and engage in another conversation about important and complex issues facing the university. I see these visits as a key part of our responsibility to collaborate in a respectful and productive manner. The University Assembly is a key governing body that brings together all aspects of the university to work with administration to address challenges and to seize opportunities. I look forward to answering the submitted questions and entering into an open discussion on these and other issues. I'm pleased to be joined by Provost Bala, who can respond to some of the specific questions posed regarding the FAU and any budgetary processes. Let me say a few words about campus climate. There has been much discussion of the campus code, temporary measures, and expressive activity policy. We have a thoughtful process underway that will report out recommendations on the student campus code, and then we will have feedback from the assemblies and the campus on that report. I am most pleased that, unlike last year, campus protests have observed the thoughtfully crafted expressive activity guidelines. In other words, protests have occurred in a way that did not infringe on the rights of others. Some of these protests have been unpleasant for others in our community. But in my view, it is important to preserve our commitment to the First Amendment, and unpleasantness is not proscribed by the Constitution. The fact that we have protests that adhere to our guidelines is something about which I take pride. Pride because we as a community tolerate disagreement and protest, and pride at the fact that protesters understand and adhere to common sense, time, place, and manner limits on those protests. Having said that, I want to take a moment to make a point about some of the conduct I have observed this year over the course of our examination and discussion of the Student Code of Conduct. Specifically, the online harassment, targeting, misinformation, and intimidation, both online and in person, that have been directed at Cornell administrators and Cornell faculty, who are diligently and faithfully doing what they have been asked to do in accordance with procedures set out through our shared governance process. Members of our community may disagree with the approach that is being taken. Expressing that disagreement is everyone's right and firmly within the spirit of shared governance. But shared governance and this university are built on a foundation of shared values that demand we treat each other, whatever our differences, with dignity and respect. Every member of this community, students, faculty, and staff, bears the responsibility to not only respect these values as individuals, but to uphold them as part of our community. When individuals choose intimidation and ad hominem attacks, deliberate misinformation, and personal harassment, the impact of that decision does not end with the individual, nor with those that have been targeted. It resonates across lives throughout our community. It corrodes the spirit of cooperation and collaboration that is so key to shared governance. It undermines the sense of safety and trust that enable us to work together in good faith. It silences voices, and it strikes at the core of who we are as an academic community. In the coming weeks, as we move to the public comment period on the draft code of conduct, I invite everyone to recognize this as an opportunity for a collective reset of how we engage with each other and use it as a model, use it to model the kind of community we want to be a part of, where every voice can be heard with respectful feedback and civil disagreement, where we recognize that we are accountable to one another and bear a shared commitment to the principles of shared governance and our democratic traditions. Thank you. I'd be glad to move to the questions.
Thank you. Is there any questions particularly relevant to what was stated that anyone would like?
I'm going to go there.
We're about to touch the pre-submitted, but in order of relevance, right? Have anyone said, had anything to say about that in particular? Seeing that there's none, I'll go ahead and move on to our questions. The first question that we have relates to aligning UA support with the president's priorities. The first question is, how can the university assembly assist and contribute meaningfully to the president and our Cornell administration's initiatives this year, such as Resilient Cornell and the Committee on the Future of the American University?
So I'll speak about Resilient Cornell and then turn to KB about FAU. But Resilient Cornell is really about how we organize the business of the university efficiently so that we can invest as much as possible in our core missions of education, research, and impact. It's a big effort that involves faculty, staff, and student leadership from across the university. Many of the issues involve how we do the work necessary to run the university in the simplest and most consistent manner across all of our campuses and throughout all of our colleges. We need the UA's questions and input as these designs roll out and as we understand how they apply to individual units in our university. This project will work best if we work together and not assume adversarial stances or simply defend the status quo. KB and I would be happy to meet with UA leadership if there are specific issues that are of concern. And as we roll out these plans for reorganization, we'd be open to those meetings. So I'll defer to KB for an update on the FAU.
So thank you all for inviting me to this meeting. This is my first UA meeting. Pleasure to be here. So as Mike said, I'll talk about the FAU committee. They have really appreciated the opportunity to get insights and feedback from all of the assemblies. They met with them. They're still in their listening phase. They just shared with me that they've had about 60 odd different listening events. There's a GPSA event tomorrow evening that's happening. You can also give feedback to them at the fau@cornell.edu email address, or in keeping with the theme of the committee, there's an AI chat bot that's off the initiatives page. It's in the Shaping Cornell's Future. It's very designed to be very safe. We'd love to get your input if you'd like to interact through a chat session, as you know, how AI could is likely to potentially transform how we think about education and research and scholarship and engagement is one of the missions or one of the charges to the committee. They have established subcommittees for the four missions: undergraduate education, graduate education, research scholarship, and public engagement. Those subcommittees have advisory panels, which include faculty, tenure track NRT faculty, staff, and students. So you may know people who are already engaged with them, and they continue to do their listening sessions. They're going to move soon over the next month into then pulling all these recommendations together into their preliminary sort of feedback that they'll bring in town halls around in April and May. So I hope that the community will engage very deeply with them at that time. Their plan is to get that round of feedback to their first round of suggestions. And then over summer is when they're going to then work on the report. We want to try to make sure that we catch the students and the faculty and everybody who leaves for summer before they leave. So it'll be end April and May. And then, as I said, they'll take all of that input again and then come up with the final. We have another person who's on that committee who can comment. You can comment. That's a rough timeline. So many opportunities to engage. We show up for the events when they're advertised. We'd love to get more.
Thank you. Is there any follow-up questions regarding the answer to our first question? Okay. Yes, Wendy.
Hopefully you can hear me now.
We can.
Hooray, hooray. Thank you for joining us, President Kolakoff and Kyle and Provost Bala. Kind of on the flip side of things, that question about how shared governance can support all of these initiatives that are coming up, how would you address the fact that all of these shared governances are going to have new leadership come June or in the fall? Because like for EA, I'm only EA chair for another 3 months, and then we'll have a new EA chair in June. So you're going to have some changing leadership. How are we going to have some, you know, consistency and continuity there?
Yeah, it's a good question. I know there is, you know, institutional memory in the individual shared governance bodies, people that are on past the leadership, but I hope that once new leadership, for example, on the EA, Wendy, is appointed, that we can meet together and try and update and share these initiatives, where we are, where we've been, and where we're going.
Sounds good. I'll hold you to it. We'll see you in May.
I would also say, Wendy, we just put on the Resilient Cornell website today that we have sort of given a picture of the timeline. And most of the changes or the designs that we are considering for the different groups will be announced sometime May, June. So the role of the assemblies for the next round will be sort of helping out with the implementation or
right,
putting things back together, I guess, and sort of rolling things out into the new year, the new semester.
Well, and also just to add, I do know from the EA standpoint, when the FAU committee met with us on February 4th, they actually followed up with an offer to set up an EA, like based, you know, EA members and committee members advisory group. So I'm going to be sending the co-chairs of that committee some names to have an EA advisory group.
Thanks. Yes, I was supposed to mention that. Thank you. Thank you, Wendy, for reminding me.
Thank you so much, Wendy. Any other follow-up questions? Yes, Mary, you're acknowledged.
I'm very curious to learn if there was ever a thought about maybe students on the committee, because future of the American University, again, students are a big part of it. I would love to hear like if there are any students or if they're supposed to be students.
There are students on the advisory panels that are informing different parts of the committee. So the right kinds of students for the right panels of the graduate education, the relevant people, and for the undergraduate, the relevant people. The committee, there are two, actually going to be two committees. There's this committee, which is the future of the American University, and the follow-up is going to be shaping our future. And that one is going to have, right from the get-go, different subcommittees based on what comes out of the FAU into different discussions. And there we'll have faculty, staff, students, and alumni also represented in different parts of this committee. So that is the plan for that follow-up committee. For this one, a lot of it was around questions around the core, questions around the academy. And so a faculty-based committee was the vision with the idea that there were going to be these advisory panels with input from students and employees and, you know, staff and other.
Thank you.
I know FAU recently made trips to both DC and Albany to meet with governmental officials to talk about like Cornell's work in this, as well as how that relates to the federal and state level governments. I'm wondering if you guys could like provide a little bit more like context as to like what are conversations that drew away from those trips, like where is the committee headed towards like right now, as well as like kind of how those conversations are steering, like the recommendations are coming out in like May, June, and where like what context like the assemblies can have with that context to like go and like work with you guys.
Yeah, and I'm gonna, they will probably come and talk about this at the time that, you know, they're in April and May. The way that we've always approached, and if you've attended one of their sessions, you know, they're listening sessions. So we come in, we say, here's our charge. Here are the disruptors that we think are going to change how higher education needs to evolve. Here are our core missions. We'd love to hear from you what's top of your mind. And so that'll get distilled into the reports, and I think they'll be in a position to then comment on which of them influence their report. I don't know which parts of the conversations influence, will influence their report. It's still in the future. But I think they will do a pretty comprehensive summary of the kinds of things they heard from different stakeholders. And
thank you. On to our next question. The topic revolves around drivers of austerity and the budgeting narrative shift. So this is three questions within one. So we'll go line by line. Basically, Cornell's public framing of the budget situation has shifted over time. For example, from near-term federal cuts to longer-term decisions, potential legal costs, and a desire to increase reserves. Can you clarify, one, what are the primary drivers of current austerity measures, changed financial conditions, or changes in accounting slash planning assumptions, including reserve targets?
Okay, that's a little bit more specific than the question that I have, but let me just say that Resilient Cornell has always been about creating financial flexibility necessary to meet financial shocks beyond the federal funding pauses. In fact, we began talking about Resilient Cornell before the specifics of the federal issues were clear. Right now, our finances are not resilient. We don't have a tradition of building up reserves, and we have traditionally run right on the edge. The higher education landscape is changing rapidly, and we need to be able to make investments in our excellence, restrain the pressure on tuition, and ensure access for students that cannot afford that tuition. On the federal front, we still face research budget pressures, unknowns regarding our reimbursement rates. We face endowment taxes and pressure on financial aid and foreign student enrollment. So all of these are pressures beyond the issue of the settlement that was referred to. Beyond this, we face enormous legal costs and deferred maintenance challenges across our campus. This is why I keep stressing the need to operate as efficiently as possible as a university, so we have a model that protects our core missions.
Thank you. And then the second part was, what was the genesis of the changed accounting slash planning decisions?
Well, I'm not aware of any changed accounting associated with Resilient Cornell. We have been observing our budget and our budget challenges over the last couple of years. It's something we look at constantly. And we have had concerns, as I say, about the fact that we're not generating the kinds of reserves, and we are facing these pressures that we feel are likely to, if we don't plan for them, likely to disrupt our core missions.
Thank you. Any follow-up questions regarding this? No. Seeing that there is none. Oh, Wendy, you're acknowledged.
Sorry, I was late to raise my hand. I think with the budget, and this is just some thoughts of my own and from what I've heard from staff members as well, I think the messaging of the infamous financial austerity email from last June, it made it seem like we're doing these budget cuts in the Resilient Cornell due to the cuts from the federal government. It wasn't clear to a lot of individuals that this has been ongoing for a while, and it's something that you all have been looking at for a while. So I just think maybe moving forward a little bit clearer messaging or communication would be helpful.
Yeah, that's a good suggestion, Wendy. And of course, it's difficult, given the fact that we've had this severe threat from the federal government on our funding. And we're in a process of this financial reorganization. It's difficult for people not to conflate those two things, but we will, it's a great suggestion, we will continue to try and separate those events.
And if I can just add, there are two things that will continue to be unpredictable for us. We still don't know where IDCs and grant funding is going to land. While grant funding, there was a lot of uncertainty around whether agencies will have the budget They may have the budget, but it is still the case that they may not give it to RPIs. And we are seeing a drop in funding rates. NIH, there was an article just this morning about how NIH did not really give many grants last year. And we have seen that effect. So the grants itself have decreased. The IDCs, we still don't know what's going to happen. That's on the research front. And the international population, for us, we sit at the edge of our seats every year to know how that's going to play out, whether the people will be able to flow in to the university or not at the, at that appropriate few weeks when they come into town. We just don't know. So those add a lot of uncertainty to our budget planning, which is something that we have to keep in mind. And that's more uncertain now than it was certainly 2 years ago.
Thank you. Any
follow-up
questions regarding this? Okay, seeing that there's none, we can move on to the third question regarding sustaining the research mission amid funding constraints. So this question is, ongoing uncertainty in government funding priorities has generated unprecedented stress for faculty and trainees in sustaining their research and training. This includes restrictions on the number of grant proposals that can be submitted. Scientific expertise and findings contribute significantly to institutional legacy, to intellectual property, for revenue generation, and critically, to credentialing for future alumni careers. What institutional strategy is being developed to financially sustain this aspect of our mission? And in your view, who is responsible for this financial burden?
Yeah, well, I couldn't agree more with the with a concern about our ability to invest in our mission, particularly our research mission, as this question asks. And this gets back to my answer about Resilient Cornell. We need to invest more in research from our own resources. That requires the financial flexibility that I referred to be able to dedicate funds to research. But in addition, we also need to expand our efforts to seek funding from non-federal sources. This will require investment and effective organization on the part of the university. Finally, we need to redouble our efforts with Congress explaining the importance of what we do and arguing for continuing federal funding. The efforts this year have reversed some of the more extreme proposals on federal budgets that we saw at the beginning of the year, but the threat has not gone away. And as we both said, the issue of our indirect costs, our reimbursement rates is out there, and other issues of federal funding are threats. So all of that really argues for a strategy that secures the kind of financial flexibility available to be able to research, to invest in our missions.
Thank you. Any follow-up questions to that? Seeing that there is none, we can go ahead and move on to our fourth question that relates to student privacy and vendor contracting, like the Gmail suite. In light of ongoing revelations that Google has provided extensive information to the federal government about at least one of our students, has Cornell investigated whether our policies, values, and students are sufficiently protected by contracting and licensing agreements, for example, again, Cornell's of the Gmail suite?
So yes, in terms of investigating that, Cornell's use of Google's products, like individual use, is subject to the company's online terms of service. Per those terms of service, Google makes it clear that it only discloses confidential information when it is legally required to do so. For example, a court order, a subpoena, a warrant, et cetera. Responding to the premise of the question, I have to say that we are not aware of any evidence that Google did provide data to the federal government about any of our students, and certainly not that Google provided any information outside of its terms of service. That said, we don't have any visibility into communications between the government and Google. For those reasons, the fact that we have no evidence that Google provided the kinds of records that you're referring to, and the fact that our terms of service state that Google's responsibility to only provide data when compelled to by law, I don't see a compelling rationale to deny the campus access to functions like Google Mail, which are widely used by the Cornell community.
Thank you. Any follow-up questions? Okay. Seeing that there is none, we can move on to our fifth question, talking about federal access to internal disciplinary documents and support for affected students. Last year, some of our students were deported, while others were terrified after being targeted by hate groups, including one now prohibited from operating in New York State. New students who might have enriched our community have stayed away. In at least one of the deportation cases, federal attorneys had access to our internal administrative disciplinary documents. Cornell leadership has reassured us that they did not receive any subpoena nor turn over such documents. Has Cornell investigated how the federal government gained access to our internal documents to prevent this from happening again? Will Cornell do anything to mark the enforced absence of our fellow students from the university?
So again, I just have to question the premise of this question. We do not know that the federal government had access to internal disciplinary documents. We provided no such access. We also know that the fact that students were arrested and subject to different disciplinary processes was widely and publicly reported, including through interviews by the students themselves. And it is also not the case that several of our students were deported, as stated. We know of two international students whose service records were terminated by the government, and one of whom publicly stated that his decision to self-deport. So it is very, very rare for an international student to have their visa revoked. The university as a team of advisors in international services to support students who have immigration questions or issues. Our international students are, of course, very important members of our community. We support them as much as we possibly can, including by providing access to consultation service with local immigration lawyers. And our view is that we are protecting our students. I've spent a fair amount of personal time going abroad, reassuring individuals, parents of individuals applying to Cornell, that Cornell is a safe place for international students to attend and that they're very successful.
Thank you. Any follow-ups? Ishan, you're not.
Yeah. I'm going to look a little bit like outside the premise of the question because I'm not super well informed about the basis of it. Just speaking generally, I mean, these are unprecedented times for international students, period. I'm a campus tour guide, and whenever I go past Caldwell Hall and I talk about, like, the Office of Global Learning and International Students, now more than ever before, like, my own little gauge is that I get asked all the time, like, what it's like for an international student to be, like, on campus.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, like, has there been a change in internal policy or, like, a ramp up of like support that like has been given to international students, given all of these like facts that we know? Like, I mean, I know you guys talked about like it was on students, like we only had two cases of students going back and like of the one who said that they were going to self-deport. I mean, in our ideal version, I don't think we want anyone wanting to self-deport or like going back their own country before they finish their education. So I'm just really wondering in terms of like from a very high level macro perspective, what can administration do to kind of go and help support international students? And has there already been a change in terms of current policy towards supporting international students?
Yes. So in response to current stress on international students, we ramped up our information to those students. We have Know Your Rights on the international student website. We've, as I said, provided consultation to individuals. We've also, as I've said, tried to talk about the safety and the success of international students here at Cornell. So all of that we've done. Of course, we cannot control federal policy. We can't control the press and the the publicity around all the things that are going on across the country in terms of immigration policy. All of that, I think, compels us to try and make sure that we protect the both protect the international community that's here by giving them as much information and protecting them to the extent that we can, and also that we continue to make it clear how important international students are to this community. They're absolutely vital to this community, have been since our founding, and will continue to be.
Thank you. Any other follow-up questions? Seeing that there's none, we can now talk about our last pre-submitted question revolving timeliness of responses to student assembly resolutions. The student assembly has recently passed numerous resolutions that have failed to receive a response from you within the 30-day time period. A, why is this? And B, do you think that it is fair to believe or believe in the shared governance system, and do you agree to cooperate in the system?
Certainly. So I'm committed to engaging with all of our bodies of shared governance and ask that we continue to work together from a place of good faith and understanding. We seriously consider resolutions from the assembly, and this usually involves some research on the underlying issues and discussions among senior leadership, which means finding time across multiple, very full schedules. In the fall semester, we received 23 resolutions and a referendum. 14 of these were from the SA. 5 were related to the Student Code of Conduct, with most of these coming right before the winter break. Responses were sent on February 6th. Last spring, SA sent 26 resolutions, 10 arriving on the same day. This makes it extremely challenging to respond to all within 30 days. When something is delayed, my office informs the SA president, as been a longstanding practice. I'm planning to ask the SA to work more closely with their advisors and campus staff to ensure they have a complete picture of an issue before submitting a resolution. Sometimes what I receive includes inaccurate or mischaracterized information. This can delay the response as we track down the correct information. And finally, I am working with my team to try and improve our response time. So I think we need to work together to try and improve this. And that means less redundant, fewer resolutions, those timed in a way that allows us to respond in an effective manner. And it also involves us trying to be as efficient as possible. And I think we can make some improvements in all of those areas.
Thank you. Any follow-up questions? Okay, seeing that there is none, I'm opening the floor to any questions that were perhaps not pre-submitted. We have about 5 minutes remaining for such. If not, potentially, we could perhaps talk about some of the topics that were put forward, sent over to us that didn't necessarily have questions that you could